Wars of Doctor Who. Star Wars of Doctor Who. Star Wars of Doctor Who.
His name is Rob.
His name is Rob.
He knows his Wookiees from his Daleks. Listen now.
Listen now.
Hear the Force challenge the TARDIS. Get your blue milk and jelly babies while we see which drives you crazy. Star Wars or Doctor Who.
Hey there, everyone, and welcome to Who Wars, the podcast for those among us who just can't decide between Star Wars and Doctor Who. I'm your host, Rob Irwin, and up front, I've got to make some apologies to the Star Wars fans out there. Like last Wednesday's episode, this is going to be a Doctor Who-only affair, and there's a good reason for that. It's not that I've gone off Star Wars, it's that today, the 23rd of November, is Doctor Who's 51st anniversary, so it seemed right that with the anniversary falling on the same day we put out Who Wars, that the show really should be a 51st anniversary special, and in that respect, all of the content you'll hear today is Doctor Who related. But it swings and roundabouts, I'm sure, when May the 4th comes around, whichever show we're doing closest to that will likely be a Star Wars only special, and there is plenty of Star Wars content to come in the next episode. I can already see some episodes of Star Wars Rebels starting to bank up and all sorts of interesting news out there. So hang tight, Star Wars fans. Hopefully, though, you're a fan of both Star Wars and Doctor Who, so you're happy to listen to either. So yeah, this is our 51st anniversary episode, and in keeping with that theme, and in keeping with the general theme of Who Wars being a grassroots podcast, you know, made by fans for fans, we're not trying to be anything other than fans here on the podcast, it's my great pleasure that this episode is made up of two features. One is myself talking about my fandom and how I came to Doctor Who in the classic era, and I have some questions from Lex and Kate during that feature. And then the second feature is the ladies of Who Wars. That's right, Kate and Lex and Leo, who all came to Doctor Who in the modern era of the show, you know, in the post-2005 era, and they talk about their fandom to me, which I did as three separate interviews that I've now stitched together. And it's really interesting, actually, that between the three of them, one has Eccleston as a favourite Doctor, one has Tennant as a favourite Doctor, and one has Smith as a favourite Doctor. Now, I'm not going to say which is which, but that's one of the interesting things I learned during these interviews, but if you want to learn more, you're going to have to listen to the interviews. Now, before we get on to some news stories of the week and things I just found interesting, I do want to say, in general, it's a real pleasure to be a Doctor Who fan. You'll hear this come through in the features later in the episode, but let me just say up front, it's a real pleasure to be a fan of a show where the hero doesn't solve everything with a gun, and where, you know, intelligence is important, and which really encourages creativity among the fans. I mean, I look at the classic era fans that I grew up with, and so many of them went into writing or television even, based on the fact they like Doctor Who. I mean, you hear similar stories about Star Wars as well. You know, people grew up with Star Wars and then often went into the movie-making business and learning to be directors or editors or whatever. So, like Star Wars, Doctor Who has inspired many, many people in many creative ways. And that's outside of the show itself. Inside the show, I think there's a great many lessons to be learned. I think the Doctor is a great role model. You know, that's not to say that I'm being all, you know, pious and po-faced here, and I don't like shows where the hero carries a gun or whatever. Doctor Who is this wonderfully different show, and it's the differences that I celebrate when I think about Doctor Who and my fandom of it, and the way it's just so different to anything else on television or even in film. And I think a good part of that can be attributed to the fact it's a BBC production where ratings don't matter. Now, I'm sure some people over there in the UK have just spat out their Rice Krispies when I say that, because to some degree ratings do matter, and in the modern era they matter more and more with regard to, you know, worldwide sales and things like that. But even now, still at its core, the BBC does put out shows for more niche audiences. They put out shows that, you know, don't have to have quite the mass appeal that a show on a commercial network would have, and I think that's something that sustained Doctor Who certainly through all of the classic era. Until eventually it did become untenable, even for the BBC, which is really saying something. And even here in the modern era, where there's a lot more fans, I think the show could probably take a good hit, you know, of a million or two in the ratings, and it probably wouldn't matter so much. But anyway, let's not dwell on that kind of thing. I just thought it was interesting to point out that one of the key aspects of Doctor Who's longevity is the BBC, you know, and the backing of the BBC and the BBC's mandate being a government-run station rather than just a commercial enterprise. So with that thought out of the way, let's move on to my top three, this time, stories of the week. Okay, so on to my top three stories of the week, and the first one is probably the most important, and that's both The Hollywood Reporter and Inquisitor are talking about Peter Capaldi signing for Season 9 of Doctor Who, or Series 9, as we say in the modern era. And this is interesting to me, because I would have thought that Capaldi's original contract would have been for, you know, 2 years plus a third year extension, or 3 years plus a fourth year extension, or something along those lines. I wouldn't have thought he signed up for a one-year contract, meaning he has to sign for Season 9. So I'm not sure whether Hollywood Reporter and Inquisitor have got this wrong, or whether they're using it as just shorthand for the fact that he's coming back. If it's the latter, it's a bit sloppy, because I don't think he really has signed for Season 9. I think he would have signed for Season 9 in his original contract. But I digress. There's a nice quote from Capaldi that I want to read. He says, "I get up at 6:30 in the morning, and by 7 o'clock I'm fighting Daleks, running down corridors, skipping down ventilation shafts. That's a great way to be living your life at this age, I think." Now keep in mind, Capaldi is now 56. And there's another quote from him that I do enjoy as well. And it runs, "When people see you, they meet you, or they meet me, they very kindly project the character of Doctor Who upon me," he says. "They are always very pleased to see Doctor Who, so I get more smiles and affection than I would normally. You have a real sense of how much the show means to those who love it." That's very cool. I think it would be great to be the Doctor. Can you imagine walking down the road and just having so much goodwill from people? Because I find that even when people don't like the episode so much, they tend to still really like the Doctor. And just imagine that goodwill of people coming up and saying, "Hey, good on you, mate," and patting you on the back. It would be a very affirming role, I think, a very life-affirming role. And if you're feeling a bit down on any given day, I think just a walk down to buy a bottle of milk would probably pick you up for the next month with the kind of things people would come up and say to you. Just incredible. And like I was saying in the introduction to the show, there's probably very few shows like it in that respect as well. You know, there are some heroes out there, there are some people who are well regarded, but I'm not sure many film stars, based on the parts they play, get that kind of just love and affection from fans. It's really quite something. Now, the second part of Capaldi coming back, or signing for Season 9, as some outlets are liking to say, is, will Jenna Coleman come back as well? Now, we know she's in the Christmas special. 2 episodes ago, I even played you some audio of Clara appearing in the Christmas special. So she's definitely in that, even though the inference at the end of Series 8 was she's not, you know, she's left the Doctor, that's the end, and she wasn't in the initial trailer for the Christmas special, similar to Mummy on the Orient Express, where we thought she might not have appeared in that, and she wasn't in the trailer there either. But we do know that she's in it, but is she in Series 9? Well, you know, if I lick my finger and hold it up to the wind, the way the wind's blowing today, November 23, I think the Christmas episode will be her last. I think, you know, in that clip that I played with the Doctor appearing and saying, "Clara, you've got to come with me now, you've got to come with me now," or, you know, however the quote actually ran, it was clear that the Doctor had found out something very important in relation to Clara. Now, is she pregnant? Does it relate to a pregnancy? Well, maybe not. Has the Doctor found a way for her to get to Danny, or talk to Danny? Maybe. You know, the Christmas episodes are generally happy and have some sort of jovial, you know, mood, even if just at the end of the episode. And I'm wondering whether Clara will have some sort of Christmas miracle and get reunited with Danny, either by going to be with him, which could be tragic in the short term, could mean her dying, or whether it means Danny comes back. I mean, we saw Danny send the young child back. Maybe the Doctor's found another way to open up that that hole in time and space, or whatever the heck it was meant to be, and can bring Danny back as well. Or maybe he can bring Danny back just for Christmas. That would be interesting. You know, he can bring Danny back, but it's only for Christmas dinner or something. And then maybe at the end, Clara goes back with him to wherever he came from. I'm just spitballing here. These aren't spoilers because I'm just making things up. But it does make you think. Now, that's how the wind's blowing to me on this issue, but you do have to remember, as I've pointed out several times on the podcast, in the Titan Comics 12th Doctor comic, Clara is the ongoing companion. In comics, they have the option of just having generic companions, pretending it's the Doctor and a companion from some, you know, unknown period on television, and they could have done that, and in fact, that's what they're doing with the Matt Smith Doctor and David Tennant Doctor comics. They're with different companions, different to what we saw on television. But with the 12th Doctor, they've specifically put him with Clara. And that series is continuing into the new year with Clara. It makes you wonder whether they're doing that because Clara is the companion next year as well. Now, again, I think the wind's blowing in the opposite direction. I think Clara does leave at Christmas. And that's that. But there's always a but. Moving on, and the final two stories I'll look at here are both list-based. The first is from Digital Spy, and it's 8 Things We Learned at the Series 8 DVD launch. So a nice tie-in there between 8 Things and the Series 8 launch, haha. The second thing is from metro.co.uk, and it's 9 Things That Have Happened Since the 50th Anniversary. So I'm not sure why they chose 9. Maybe they should have, you know, selected 12, because Capaldi is the 12th Doctor? I don't know. But let's go back to the Digital Spy one first. And the 8 things we learned are... Number 1. Before filming began, Stephen Moffat enacted the entirety of Season 8 for Peter Capaldi in his kitchen. Now, wouldn't that have been a funny thing to have seen Moffat literally act out the whole series? I think that would have been quite cool. I wish someone had had a video camera on that. That would have been awesome. It makes me think, too, was he trying to sell Capaldi on the whole series and what he had planned out? You know, was Capaldi maybe dithering on whether to be the Doctor or not? I wouldn't think so. So it's interesting, though, that Moffat still decided to give it all away, apparently, in his kitchen in one go, acting it out. That would have been very, very fun to watch. Number 2, Moffat still finds the experience of making Doctor Who terrifying. And I'll actually read the quote here because it's quite interesting. Moffat says, "Each time you make a big shift, which is what we did this year, then you're properly worried. It's like being the curator of the Crown Jewels or something. At the same time, you have to shut off that in your mind. You've got to treat it like you own it, even though you don't. You have to be bold with it. If all you're ever doing is tending to the upkeep of the monument, then it's not going to be a proper TV show." And you know, this is where I think Moffat gets into a lot of trouble with fans, because he does stretch himself. He does try new things. He does come up with concepts that make fans... you know, both old and new, sit up and say, "What are you doing? How can you do that? You know, how can you invent the John Hurt Doctor? How can you do this, that, and the other?" It's funny, if Moffat didn't do those things, the show would just stagnate and be the same year in, year out. And while that would appeal to a percentage of fans, I'm not going to say what kind of percentage, whether it's 10% or 20% of fans, you know, there is a percentage of fans out there who would like Doctor Who to be nice, comfortable, safe, traditional, and always be the same. And you know, when you think of that sort of conservatism, it's very comfortable to be in that position, and it's like an old pair of slippers that you slip on, and you know, some people would really revel in that. But I think, you know, for a show like Doctor Who, which even in its early days was pushing the boundaries, when they said William Hartnell has to go, they invented the concept of regeneration, you know. Some of the creatures they came up with, some of the backgrounds to these things. You know, Doctor Who has always been about change and pushing the boundaries. And if Moffat wasn't doing those things, I think that would be a greater crime than inventing the War Doctor or suggesting that Matt Smith was actually, you know, the 13th Doctor or whatever he ended up being, and so on and so forth. So I get where he's coming from here. It's kind of a damned if you do, damned if you don't scenario, but I think he's erring on the right side to, you know, just getting in there and being bold with it, as he says. Number 3 is, Moffat is responsible for even more Doctor Who than you might think, and this briefly touches on the fact that this series in particular, he did, I guess not so much rewriting, he explains it as engineering rather than authorship, getting into scripts and just tweaking them a bit so that they fitted the overall new sort of attitude and tone of this series, and I guess he thought he did it to some degree in a bigger way than in past series, where he would tweak things and engineer them, but he wouldn't put his name as a co-writer, and this series he did tend to do that a bit more, so that was interesting. But he goes on to talk about, you know, some of the downfalls of this by saying, I remember once reading a review of a Doctor Who episode which listed a whole lot of really funny lines saying, this is the kind of thing we haven't had since Moffat took over, and I wrote every single one. So there's an example of where someone else had written the episode, but the jokes in it had come from Moffat, but didn't get attributed to him. I guess on the flip side of the coin, there are things like Into the Dalek, which was written by, gosh, who was that? Was it Phil Ford? And it was credited to Phil Ford and Stephen Moffat. And whenever I saw someone have an issue with that particular episode, whatever the issue was, they laid it fairly and squarely at Moffat's feet. And I thought, what's with that? You know, the actual lead writer is Phil Ford. The guy who probably wrote three quarters of this or more is Phil Ford. You know, Moffat might have slipped in lines here and there or a concept here and there, but on the whole, it was Phil Ford. I guess it goes to show that people do like to blame Moffat for things even when he's not responsible, and there are two sides of the coin, either not getting credited for the funny jokes or getting criticised for things that he might not have written at all just because his name was up there as a co-writer. So, again, damned if you do, damned if you don't, if you're Moffat. Number four, neither Moffat nor Capaldi agree that this series of Doctor Who has been darker. I find this a really interesting comment, actually, from both of them. I wonder if they're so close to the material they can't see it. I think Series 8 was more than dark. It was incredibly dark. It was really different to past series. I mean, you think of some of the visuals, you think of that policeman being shot in The Caretaker, you think of just his blackened hand, just a stump attached to this hand, blackened, missing a finger or two, smoking, hits the ground. I don't think we'd seen anything like that in past series of recent Doctor Who. Or you think of more psychologically dark stuff, like the Doctor leaving Clara and Courtney and the astronaut to, you know, make up the fate of the world in Kill the Moon. He just leaves in the TARDIS and says, you know, good luck. That's psychologically really dark. Danny Pink being run over and resurrected as a Cyberman who wants to get rid of his humanity because it hurts so much. Gosh, that's dark. This was a dark series, you know, at least as dark as anything that's come before, and I think much darker, personally. So when Moffat says, we never said it would be darker, we never said it at all, and Capaldi says, I don't know what they're talking about, people say it's very dark this year, and, you know, what does that mean? Have we not put money in the meter? I mean, that's a very funny line from Capaldi, but are they for real? I think this was a much darker series. Number five, one popular fan theory about the 50th anniversary special is utter cobblers. Now, this probably doesn't work so well on a podcast, but there is a scene in the 50th anniversary where Clara is looking off in the picture to the left, and there's a hand in the foreground sort of clawing its way up and grabbing onto a wall, and people are saying, oh, that's Missy escaping Gallifrey. But Clara, or I should say Jenna, revealed at this DVD launch that it's actually her hand, and Moffat quipped, we don't employ different people to be her appendages. So that fan theory, if you've ever heard it, that Missy's hand is in the 50th anniversary special, no, it's not true. Number six, Samuel Anderson didn't know that Danny would die in Death in Heaven until the read-through, and we've got a quote from him saying, I got that script on the day of travelling down to do the read-through. And then Moffat recalls, I walked into that read-through and there was Ingrid, and he's referring to Ingrid Oliver, who plays Osgood, and Sam, obviously, Samuel Anderson. I thought, oh yeah, I just killed them. I better go and say hello. I do enjoy Moffat's humour. Number seven, Doctor Who's Santa is a Christmas hero. This Christmas, the Doctor will meet Santa, played by Nick Frost, but for anyone concerned that this festive figure will be exposed as an alien or a robot, you can relax. Santa could never be evil, for heaven's sake, gasped Moffat. Santa is both real and a Christmas hero. Any parents who are worried about that, Santa is presented as he is in real life, a great Christmas hero. So, there you go. Parents, don't be worried. Kids, Santa exists in Doctor Who. Number eight. Next series, Capaldi wants a run-in with some old-school Cybermen. The story runs, the panel climaxed with a spectacular exchange between Capaldi and Moffat that culminated in the latter lamenting, no women are ever going to talk to us again. The geek-off between these two lifelong Who fans concerned the mythology of the Cybermen, with Capaldi keen to reintroduce the more primitive version of the monsters from Mondas, who debuted in 1966's The Tenth Planet. I do love them, he admitted. The ones in The Tenth Planet were more Frankenstein creatures with human hands. And the phrase Mondasian Cybermen sounds fantastic. I've got to agree with him there. You know, I've often thought over the years, even back in the classic era, say when I was watching, you know, My Doctor, Peter Davison, and, you know, his Cyberman story was Earthshock, and I think of how fabulous the Cybermen looked in that, and then they came back in the same costume in the Five Doctors, and then, you know, it was a similar costume for Colin Baker's Cyberman story, and they were slightly tweaked for Silver Nemesis, Sylvester McCoy's story with the Cybermen, but in general they sort of stayed the same for a while. And I was thinking, wouldn't it be great if, you know, like the McCoy Doctor met Cybermen who looked like the I don't know, the Cybermen from Revenge of the Cybermen with Tom Baker, or The Invasion with Patrick Troughton, or something like that, you know, because in theory the Doctor could go back in times to where the Cybermen look different. And I guess they always want to present the Cybermen looking as good as they can on screen, but wouldn't it be great if we saw some 10th Planet Cybermen? I got a little thrill even in the final episode of Series 8 where we saw an old Cyberman head from The Invasion. Kate Stewart threw it on the ground and we saw a quick look at it. I thought that was very cool. I would love to see the Doctor actually encounter real Cybermen from the 10th Planet, though. That would just be awesome. I think they could be made to look really creepy. They really are like Frankenstein's monster. They really are quite human, just augmented a bit, not just brains or, you know, some other bits of a body put into a largely cybernetic shell. They are more, I would like to say, more man than machine in the 10th Planet. They've obviously been converted to some degree, but I think a lot of the human body is still there. Yeah, I'd like to see that. Anyway, I digress. There's a second story to get onto here, and it's from metro.co.uk, and it's 9 unique things that have happened since the 50th anniversary. And the first one it lists is 12 regenerations limit is gone. Now, I've got to take issue with that. I don't think the 12 regenerations limit was really a limit in the way people think of limits, if that makes sense. Yes, there was a limit on regenerations discussed in a Tom Baker episode. I'm trying to remember which one it was. I can't think of it off the top of my head. And that was the first time it was introduced. But then, as early as the Five Doctors, we had the Master being offered a new regeneration cycle by the Time Lords. And so it was clear that although there was a limit, there could be new regeneration cycles granted by, you know, the High Council of Time Lords. You know, all the way through Doctor Who, even in the classic era, people would talk about this, and I'd say, well, in the Five Doctors, the Master's, you know, offered a new regeneration cycle, the Time Lords can do this. If we finally get to the day where the Doctor is onto his last regeneration, I'm sure he'll save Gallifrey or do something that will mean the Time Lords give him a new regeneration cycle. It's within their power, and they seem to be able to grant it, you know, pretty easily, if the Five Doctors is any sort of indication. So I was never worried about that, and it's funny that in the end, you know, when as a kid I was thinking, you know, he'll save Gallifrey or he'll do something and he'll end up getting a new regeneration cycle, and that's pretty much what happened, you know, all these years later. You know, the little me back in 86 or 87 or whenever I was having that thought for the first time, it eventually came true. Something else that happened since the 50th anniversary, Stephen Moffat created another new Doctor, and this comes from the Time of the Doctor, of course. When explaining his regeneration cycle to Clara, Matt Smith revealed that the 10th Doctor, played by David Tennant, was actually his 11th and 12th regenerations, John Hurt's War Doctor being the 9th, as he explained in The Name of the Doctor and The Day of the Doctor. Apparently he regenerated into himself in the Series 4 finale as he had vanity issues. Confused? Question mark. Well, no, I'm not confused, but I do think it's more messy than it had to be. I think the War Doctor was created out of, you know, circumstances. I would have much rather seen Paul McGann as the War Doctor. You know, people say they wanted to see Eccleston as the War Doctor, but that actually makes no sense because Eccleston was freshly regenerated at the start of Rose. So how could he have fought through the whole Time War and then been freshly regenerated in Rose? Clearly the War Doctor should have been the Eighth Doctor, should have been Paul McGann. Moffat said at the time, you know, I just couldn't have seen the Eighth Doctor doing it, but I think through Night of the Doctor we saw the way in which the Doctor could eventually turn, and what a great tragedy it would have been for the nicest man in the universe, which is, you know, kind of what the Eighth Doctor's persona is, to have eventually turned so far that he then fought the Time War and became a soldier. I think both Paul McGann could have played that, and I think it would have been credible and dramatic for the character of the Eighth Doctor to have done that. And in that way, we never would have had to invent the War Doctor at all. and we wouldn't have had to have played around with this fact that the 10th Doctor had regenerated into himself and used up a regeneration, and, you know, we could have just stuck to the conventions of which Doctor is which, but Stephen Moffat created a new Doctor, I guess he did. We got a new longer-serving companion, and the companion they're giving this title to, and I might dispute this, is Handles, the Cyberhead. And it's referred to that in Time of the Doctor, he's stayed with Matt Smith for around 300 years, and they joke almost as old as Peter Capaldi. Haha. Well, could you consider Clara a companion for longer than that, when you consider that Clara did go off into the Doctor's time stream, split herself up, and maybe didn't have full adventures with each Doctor, but did save the Doctor all over the place, so had sort of accompanied the Doctor to some degree since his very first regeneration. So, although it's kind of fun to think that Handles the Cyberhead might be the longest-serving companion, I think it might be Clara, technically. What else did we learn? We learned that the Doctor was a crybaby child in a barn. Who would have thunk it? Clara discovered the young Doctor unable to sleep and listen and ended up creating his fear of the dark. In the young Gallifreyan's defence, his guardians were hardly sympathetic. And, yeah, isn't that true? The people who were looking after him, whoever they were, they had him out in the barn. They, I think they wanted him to come in. I don't think they were entirely unsympathetic, but it was interesting to have that vision of the Doctor, who we've always thought of in a certain way, to have actually been out there crying in the barn like that. It was beautiful. I love Listeners. One of my two favourite episodes, actually, of Season 8. What else did we learn? We learned the Moon is an egg, perhaps the boldest of moves ever in Doctor Who. Our orbiting satellite will turn into a gargantuan space dragon after hatching in 2049, according to the superb story, Kill the Moon. Well, that's their word, superb. I wouldn't call Kill the Moon superb at all. In fact, I really didn't like it. But I guess it was brave to say that the Moon was an egg, and the creature who hatched from it could, you know, create another egg that was bigger than itself, and before it hatched, it got heavier, when no egg I know of does that. Yes, I didn't like the science and Kill the Moon at all. And we have had a long discussion on dodgy science. It's in our Season 8 review, Part 2, which you may have heard. You can go and listen to it there. I won't go into all of it now. What else did we learn? The TARDIS ended up in a handbag. They talk here about Flatline and the TARDIS shrinking and being carried around in Clara's bag. Yes, I guess that was cute, but they're not thinking of episodes like the Gopless, and I think there are some others where the TARDIS has shrunk its dimensions as well, so it wasn't actually the first time it had happened. Maybe the first time it had happened to people who have only seen the new series from 2005 onward, I guess. Another thing we learned, the Doctor swears the psychic paper betrayed the Malcolm Tucker side to the Time Lord in Dark Water, where it included much swearing. He explained, "I've got a lot of internalized anger." That was actually one of my favourite moments in Dark Water. It was a bit of a Malcolm Tucker reference there, I'd like to think. What else happened? Well, the Master turned into a woman. And it's technically not that unique, as this article says, as we had previously discussed in The Doctor's Wife, that Time Lords could change gender, but it was a first for the renegade Time Lord and former pal of the Doctor. And yeah, look, again, we've talked about this on the podcast a few times, so I won't go into it. I thought it was great. I like the Missy character. I like the Master turning into a woman for this incarnation. I don't know what's going to happen in the future. I don't know whether the Master will come back as Michelle Gomez, or whether the next time we see the Master in, you know, a year or two or three, it'll be played by a different person. I'd actually like to see the Master come back in the next series and still be played by Michelle Gomez. That's how much I like the character. As for people out there who were saying, you know, mean things about it, I mean, one of them I raised on the podcast was people saying, oh, now that the Master's a woman, the next step is the Doctor becoming a woman. What are we going to call the show? Nurse Who? And it was like, oh my God, you know, just the stupidity of that comment, you know, shows you how ridiculous some of these people are out there who are against this kind of thing. And yeah, I won't go into it here, but I've got a lot of time for the Master as a woman, and I would love to see Michelle Gomez back. Even though it did look like she was killed, I don't think she was. I think she teleported just at the last minute. What else? This is the last one. The companion gets their name before the Doctor and face in the credits. And that was a nice touch, I guess, to Death in Heaven. A comedy sort of touch, that Jenna was pretending to be the Doctor, announced that she was the Doctor, and in the opening credits, Jenna Coleman's name appeared before Peter Capaldi's, and instead of Peter Capaldi's eyes in the credits, you know, zooming out towards us, it was Jenna Coleman's. And it didn't fool anyone. It didn't fool me. I don't think it would have fooled anyone. But it was fun. And so, yeah, that is something different since the 50th anniversary. Actually different in all of Doctor Who, to have the companion credited before the Doctor and to have their face, or at least their eyes, in the credits. So, yeah, look, there are some fun things there. I don't think all of them were quite on the money, but 9 unique things, thanks to metro.co.uk. And that's it. That's my top 3 stories for this week, all Doctor Who related. I hope you enjoyed that little jaunt through what people are out there saying in the media, what might be happening next series with Doctor Who, and some of the fun things we've learned over the last week or so about the series. Anyway, without any further ado, I think it's time to crack into the 2 features of this 51st anniversary episode of Who Wars. And, yeah, look, I'll let myself introduce this next one. Alright, so now let's move into the first feature of this episode of Who Wars, and to celebrate Doctor Who's 51st anniversary, I wondered what the team and I could do to achieve that. And one thought that came to me is that Who Wars is a very grassroots kind of show. In fact, we regularly appeal for people, if they have ideas for a regular or semi-regular segment, to come and talk to us about them, because we'd love to have more voices on the show. So it's a very grassroots kind of show. It's a show about people's fandom, and one of the ways I guess we can express our fandom is to talk about it. That's probably the most basic way to do it. And I remembered a book I contributed to some years ago now, called You and Who, basically a writer from Starburst magazine in late 2010, I believe, started to think, you know, what if I pulled together a book and it had people's stories about their fandom or their attitudes towards the show or whatever it might be, and pulled that into a book and, you know, gave the proceeds to charity. In this case, it's a charity called Children in Need. And he put the call out there. I answered the call along with a number of other people. And it got published by Milk Publishing as this wonderful little book called You and Who. It's out of print now. I don't know if they regularly pop up on eBay or anything like that. I'm not too sure that they would. I guess most of the people buying this were the people probably with something published in it, or friends of those people. They probably don't want to give up on their copies anytime soon. And I put a piece in You and Who called I Was a Teenage Time Lord, and it basically described my introduction to Doctor Who and how I sort of became a fan over the years and where it all went. So I thought, you know, for something a bit different, I might actually read my entry from You and Who so you can hear my story in my voice. And at the end of it, Kate and Lex have very graciously asked a number of questions relating to the story, and I'll answer those as well. So without any further ado, I was a teenage Time Lord. My earliest memory of Doctor Who comes from the late 1970s. The actual year is shrouded in mystery, but for argument's sake, let's say it was 1978 and I was probably 2 going on 3 years old. I remember my brother inviting me to watch television with him in the spare room. Or maybe it was the living room. I really can't remember. Not that it matters. This was my big brother encouraging me to come and watch television with him, and I was up for it. Next thing, the strangest music I'd ever heard in my admittedly short life started playing. It reverberated in my head and I began to lose my composure. And then when the woo part started, I fled the room in terror. It would be years before I could watch Doctor Who again. By the early 1980s, I was a little more grown up, meaning I could now hold my own against the theme tune. And I started to see more of the series because, as an Australian, we had repeats available on our government-run television station every night of the week. A very different experience to our UK cousins. These episodes I duly took in, enjoying the stories for what they were, but not being obsessive about watching them either. If I missed an episode or two, for example, or went on holidays with my family for a week, I didn't care about what might be happening on the box, so I guess you could say I was a regular viewer, but certainly not a fan by any stretch of the imagination. In 1986, however, that all changed. That was the year the great love affair started and Doctor Who got into my DNA. And like most good love affairs, it's perhaps easier to tell you how it started rather than why. Basically, I was 11 years old and able to travel around town on my own, Plus, high school was beckoning in the new year. In this new, more grown-up environment, I started to notice Doctor Who magazine in the newsagents, and Target novelizations on the shelves of those newsagents, as well as other bookstores. I began to buy the magazine. Perhaps out of curiosity, I don't really recall the moment I made the decision to take the first step, and then some of the novels, before finding myself rapidly pulled into this strange new world. Old episodes that I'd seen several times already, thanks to the repeat schedule in Australia, were now put into greater context through the magazine and novels. People would write about things I'd seen on television the previous week, as if seeing it was the equivalent of finding Tutankhamun's treasure. Strange and expensive merchandise beckoned to me. 25mm, 40mm, and 80mm miniatures. Do I really have to choose a scale? Calendars featuring art by Andrew Scaletta. By gosh, that guy could draw. Mythmakers VHS tapes. I was fascinated by the thought of watching interviews with Doctor Who actors because you just didn't see that sort of thing on television. And what on earth lay inside the Doctor Who magazine Winter Special? Where could I buy such wondrous items to worship in my bedroom? While my head was still spinning from this first flash of young love for the series and its merchandise, the Trial of a Time Lord screened on Australian television, and whatever we might say about it from the comfort of 2011, when that opening scene with the space station came on screen, I could have stood up and cheered. In fact, I probably did. This was my show, which none of my friends really understood, and it was definitely uncool to watch, and yet here it was, looking better than it ever had before. I'd started high school in 1987, and as luck would have it, my afternoon bus home left from just outside the local library. This meant I could spend some time before my bus arrived each and every day looking at Doctor Who books, learning more and more facts about the series, and generally being a complete geek. It was great. There was an amazing array of 1970s hardback Doctor Who novels on the shelves, perhaps untouched since that decade, as well as newer hardcover reference books. Peter Haining became a god to me. I memorized the episode guide in the rear of Doctor Who A Celebration until I could recite the entire era of each Doctor, barely pausing for breath. I even took to photocopying the front covers of old Doctor Who novels and building a scrapbook of the images captured. One of these afternoons, I was at the help desk inquiring if a copy of The Five Doctors could be brought over from a nearby library, as all the local libraries had some sort of reciprocal sharing arrangement with each other. An older boy came up to me as I finished giving the librarian my details, slightly wild-eyed, and asked if he'd just heard correctly, was I really requesting The Five Doctors? I nodded in the affirmative, so he began a well-rehearsed spiel about being the president of the local Doctor Who club called Time Flight. I was impressed by his sales patter and joined Time Flight on the spot, opening up an even bigger world of geekdom. Here was a group of people in my local area who were just like me. It was amazing, although I must confess my parents were initially skeptical of letting me hang around with this new crew of Doctor Who obsessed people, but they soon met them and grew used to them and would drive me to the monthly meetings where the club would watch old episodes. The president had videotaped just about everything that had screened over the past few years, which in terms of Australian repeats was quite a lot, and to talk about the series over cups of raspberry cordial. This led, as it does, to attending even bigger fan gatherings. Looking like some sort of geeky 80s street gang, the Time Flight members would get on a train and trundle into Sydney, where all the other local clubs would converge for parties, as the gatherings of the Australasian Doctor Who fan club were known. From there, we graduated to small conventions. One called Console 88 comes immediately to mind because it was the first time I'd met people from the series in the form of Mark Strickson and Julie Brennan. Not long after that, and still in our teens, we found ourselves playing unplanned, yet extremely active roles in local fandom. We were making fanzines, and the fact I became a journalist later in life can probably be traced back to this era. We were appearing on television programs, talking about our passion for the show. We were making fan films, and we were putting on skits and entertainment at fan gatherings. I remember one was a whodunit. Get it? Written by Kate Orman and featuring multiple Time Flight members, including myself playing Andrew Cartmell. Don't ask. And then, suddenly, it all started to grind to a halt. Doctor Who was cancelled in 1989, and over the next year or two, I guess it began to sink in that the great love affair was all over. I suppose it was akin to a lover who says they're just nipping out for some milk, but still hasn't returned years later, and eventually you have to let them go. Oh, sure, there were some novels being written, even by people I knew well in some cases, but they weren't new television episodes, and at that time, if it wasn't Doctor Who on the television, it simply wasn't Doctor Who to me. For 26 years, television had been the medium for most new Doctor Who material, so anything else calling itself new Doctor Who just seemed weird. The fact I was also heading towards the end of high school, thinking more about girls, learning to drive, worrying about university and so on, really didn't help the equation much either, I suppose. In my mind, the BBC had killed the series just as it had got to an interesting phase in its development. I'd grown up, and that's all there was to it. Hey-ho. So what brought me back? How do I find myself here today in a book filled with anecdotes from other Doctor Who fans? Strangely enough, it was the TV movie in 1996. While I hated much of it, some elements, like the new-look TARDIS interior and the character of the Eighth Doctor himself, were real winners with me. It inspired me to start reading the BBC's Eighth Doctor novels with some of the old passion I used to have, and within a year or two, Big Finish were making new audio adventures featuring several past Doctors. What was going on here? From there, it was only a few short years of new Doctor Who being a strange mishmash of novels, audios and comics, and before we knew it, there was a new series on our screens in 2005 to crown it all. A real series. Doctor Who was actually back on television. By the time Rose ran in rather cheesy slow motion to join the Doctor at the end of the first episode, I knew that I'd been drawn in again. It might not have been the same youthful rush of blood to the head like in the 1980s, but it was still a love rekindled, and in a sense, the series felt like the lover who nipped out for some milk had finally come home at last. And you know what? The grin hasn't left my face since. Long may the Doctor continue on our screens around the globe. That was written by me, Rob Irwin, aged 35, well, at the time, Sydney, Australia, and I've listed there favourite Doctor, Peter Davison, favourite story, The Caves of Androzani. So that's my brief backstory in Doctor Who. There is more to say. There are wonderful anecdotes I could tell. In fact, on an old blog, I wrote a version of that which was probably twice as long and, you know, hopefully a little more interesting than that. But I thought I'd just leave it to the published version, the You and Who version. And now, look, without any further ado, I've got Lex and Kate who have asked some questions, and I'll do my best to answer them. So let's start with you, Kate.
Okay, Rob. My first question is, are you still in touch with any of the members of the Time Flight Club?
Okay, am I in touch with any of the members of Time Flight? Well, yes, I am. Not in a huge way, I'll say that up front. We all tended to go our separate ways after high school, or for some of us after university. I did go to university with one of the members, in fact, the president, Mark. But after university, he moved to the US, to the UK and then the US, and now he's back in the UK. So he's thousands and thousands of kilometres away from me, but we know each other on Facebook. And when he comes back to visit his parents here in Australia every year or two, I do catch up with him. Richard, he's another member of Time Flight. I talk to him a lot on Facebook, and from time to time when I get the bug for tabletop gaming, or wargaming, some people might know it as, I catch up with Richard and we play tabletop games down at our local store. And so, yeah, I'm in touch with Richard. There was another Robert in the group. He is now a television producer. He produces The Morning Show on Channel 10 here in Australia. I chat with him a bit on Facebook. We chatted on the phone probably about six months ago or so. So I'm in touch with him. Harvey. There's a guy called Harvey. I went to high school with Harvey. And Harvey now lives in South Australia. So again, he's a fair way away from me, but we do talk almost daily on Facebook, actually, sharing funny bits of music and interesting things with each other. So there's Harvey. Who else? There are probably a few others who I'm not in direct contact with, but I see on people's Facebook walls or I hear about from time to time. Fraser, there was a chap called Fraser, became a very famous drag queen. I think he might live in Melbourne now, I'm not too sure. But I do see pictures of him and his shows. He's toured around the world, I believe, with some of those shows. A fella called Chris, he was quite funny. I mentioned that whodunit where I dressed up as Andrew Cartmell. I remember Chris dressed up as Sylvester McCoy for that. And Chris was quite into stunts. And he He actually, we're in a university theatre doing this whodunit, and he came in as Sylvester McCoy, and you might remember in the early Sylvester McCoy era, he was quite a clown. Well, Chris actually did like a fall, or do you call them a pratfall or something, down the steps leading up the middle of this university lecture hall, and he sort of rolled down these steps all the way down. I'm surprised he didn't break his neck, actually. But he was quite a good guy. I'm not in regular contact with him, but again, I know he's around. And yeah, there were probably a few other people around the periphery of the group, but I don't know about them. I think I remember one guy called Paul. There was a girl called Melissa. I think she was our only female member, and so on. I'm not sure where they're up to. So look, on the whole, I have kept in touch to some degree with a lot of Time Flight, so that's pretty cool.
We know that you are currently doing the Who Wars podcast, but are there any other ways that you express your Doctor Who fandom that we might not know about?
Okay, expressing my fandom in other ways. I'm sure that I do. I mean, I put this piece into You and Who. That was a piece of writing. There was a follow-up to You and Who called Contact Has Been Made, and that was basically fans picking a Doctor Who story and talking about it. Didn't necessarily have to be a review, but they could, you know, just talk about it in some way, maybe the way it impacted on them, you know, something creative. And I have pieces in both volumes of that. Contact Has Been Made, Volume 1 and 2. I'm sure I did the Tom Baker story, Talons of Wang Chiang, in one, and the Matt Smith story, Amy's Choice, in another. I'm not sure if I did any other stories, but I certainly have a piece, at least one piece, in both of those books. So I guess in recent times I've expressed my fandom through writing in that sort of sense, as well as doing this Who Wars podcast. I've had websites / blogs that have had reviews of Doctor Who episodes. One of them had every episode from Eccleston through to the end of Matt Smith reviewed in two sentences each. That was kind of a fun thing. Aside from that, though, I'm kind of standoffish with fandom. Standoffish is the wrong word, but I don't tend to get out and do a lot of fan events. There was a period maybe 5 years ago or so where my wife and I went to a lot of conventions, and there probably weren't a lot of Doctor Who guests there, but there were certainly fans there and so on. But in more recent times, we've, you know, shied away from those to some degree. They just get so big and crowded, and my wife isn't into that, and neither am I. And in terms of local fandom, yeah, haven't done a lot with it. I joined the newer Doctor Who fan club here in Australia. I mentioned in my piece the Australasian Doctor Who fan club. That doesn't really exist anymore. I think it's now the Doctor Who fan club of Australia. I joined it, and I was actually unemployed at the time. I was having like 2 months off in between jobs trying to find a new job. And I said to them, hey, can I help you with your website? Because it wasn't that great. And, you know, do you want to have a forum? And all that sort of stuff, you know, things that I've done for gaming guilds over the years. And they sort of ummed and ahed so much about it that my 2 months out of work came and went. And I think they came to me about 3 or 4 months later or something and said, hey, do you want to build that forum now? Do you want to help on the website? I was like, gosh, guys, I would have done it a while ago when I was unemployed. But now I'm actually super, super busy and don't even have enough time to myself these days, let alone, you know, building websites and forums and stuff for you. So sorry about that. So I tried to express my fandom there, I guess, with them. But I guess this rather meandering answer is coming around to the fact that I probably don't do a lot. I'm just a bit in the background now, like a grandfatherly sort of figure. I do my little bits here and there, and I enjoy doing the podcast. But aside from that, I'm not really out there trying to make stuff happen or editing my own books or anything like that. You know, kudos to those people who do. I'm just not at that stage in my life anymore.
Other than the television show, what's your favorite Doctor Who medium?
Okay, favorite Doctor Who medium other than television. It's a hard one. I would say novels. I mean, novels and audio are probably the two big ones. And I say novels just because it's a little more traditional. The Big Finish people do wonderful work, but, you know, even in the audio format, some of the older Doctors still don't sound like their old selves. They sound older, a bit more broken down. And, you know, I heard some of the Tom Baker Big Finish pieces recently, and I thought, gosh, for a guy who maintained such a big, booming, character-filled voice for such a long time, his voice on the Big Finish audios makes me a bit sad, actually. You know, you can tell this guy is getting older, and it's a shame that Tom was sort of anti-Doctor Who. Well, not anti-Doctor Who, but didn't want to do a lot with Doctor Who for a long time after leaving the show, and now that he's finally getting involved in things like the audios, he just doesn't sound like himself. But I'm getting off on a tangent there. I do think it's novels. I've always liked the novels. I mean, I was reading the Target novels when I was a kid, and then I had my big swing through the Eighth Doctor Adventures when they were being published by BBC Books. The ones I missed out on to a large degree that I alluded to in that piece were the Virgin Adventures, the New Adventures and the Missing Adventures. And although I did read some of them, for example, Kate Orman, who was an Australian writer who I even mentioned in that piece of writing, Kate Orman wrote some of them, like The Left-Handed Hummingbird and books like that. And, you know, I've read those. But on the whole, I did feel at the time that if it wasn't on TV, it wasn't really Doctor Who. It's funny now because the books are so well accepted and the audio is so well accepted. But back then, for me, as how old was I in 89? 13 years old. 13 years old, only ever known Doctor Who on television or Target novels, which were of the television stories and only came out after the television stories had aired, obviously. To think of new stories only being told in novels or in audio just seemed bizarre to me, and now it's just so well accepted. But yeah, look, quick answer, novels is definitely what I gravitate towards after TV.
And my last question, you talk a little bit about how Doctor Who was perceived as uncool when you were growing up, but I think that recently we've really seen that Doctor Who is cool and even trendy, so I was just curious, what do you attribute that to?
Well, this is a great question, and I think probably the broadest way I could, you know, answer it is to say that I think geek culture and nerd culture has become cool, and it's become cool in a very genuine way for some people out there, and I think some have sort of adopted the look and sort of jumped on it as, oh, this is the latest cool thing, you know, play video games, wear geek glasses, haha, you know, I'm part of this. Sort of like how hipsters say, oh, look, I'll grow a beard and get a check shirt. Ha ha, I'm part of, you know, being a hipster. But, you know, obviously a lot of people out there are quite genuine. They get into their fandom and they think, hey, it's cool to be a geek. And as more geeks stand up, other people think, well, if they say it's okay to be a geek, I'll be a geek now too. And so it's not so much, I think, Doctor Who becoming super cool, but I think this whole rise of geekdom and nerddom that's happened in a major way in the last 5 years, but over, say, the last 10 years or so, people are right into it. I don't see it going away anytime soon. And Doctor Who is just one of those classic sci-fi, sci-fantasy shows that to be a good geek or a good nerd, you should be into. And that could be the reason why some people start watching it and trying to get into it. Maybe they see Big Bang Theory and Sheldon's talking about Doctor Who, so they think, well, I'll give this a go. And then after watching a few episodes, they actually genuinely like the show, and it's not an affectation or doing it because it's something that you should do as a good nerd or a good geek, but something that's actually quite good. You know, it's a hard question to answer, but I do think it does lean more towards just geekdom and nerddom becoming cool more so than Doctor Who itself becoming popular. I think the return of Doctor Who in 2005 did seem to tie in with the start of the rise of the geeks or the nerds, and so it just sort of, you know, dovetailed together really well in that sense. I hope that answers the question. Anyway, that's the end of Kate's question, so let's get on to Lex and see what Lex has to say.
Hey, so I have some questions. First one, you were 2 or 3 years old? Did you really remember all that, or were you just told that by your older brother? No, but really, that is amazing.
Yeah, I guess you're right, Lex. I guess I was probably about 3. You know, I said in the piece 2 or 3. It would have been, you know, late in my 2s, getting into my 3s. It's probably in my 3s. But I do remember it. I have vivid memories of that old black and white television in that spare room and being scared of the music and so on. Again, that's not when I became a fan. I wasn't, you know, saying I was watching the show and understanding it at, you know, 3 years of age. But it's certainly a memory I have of being in that room, darkened room, actually, and being scared of the music. It's not so strange overall. I mean, I have memories of other things that happened around that age or slightly older. I can remember things I did in kindergarten, for example. And they're not things that I've been told about later because they're things that I, you know, perhaps remembered a few years after they happened, so maybe when I was 6 or 7, and then I've remembered them again when I was 8 or 9, and they've just been ongoing memories. They're not things that someone's told me 20 years after the fact, like, oh, in kindergarten you did this. I remember things I did in kindergarten, you know, the embarrassing stuff and the cool stuff. So, yeah, it's a very early memory, granted, but I have it genuinely in my head.
Where was your older brother throughout the whole time you were growing this Doctor Who obsession? Did he just desert you in the inner turmoil that is a television series fanhood? I know it's not easy being a fan all alone. So is he not a fan anymore?
That's a good question. Is my brother still a Doctor Who fan? The quick answer is yes, he is. He's watching the show and he's bought every box set that's come out since the new series came back and all of that, so he's a fan. He hasn't been that enamoured with the Capaldi era, though, which is strange, because I thought Capaldi would have really resonated with him. But in the conversations we've had, only a few of them, he hasn't been that enamoured with it, which is interesting. So, yes, he's a fan, but no, he didn't enjoy this last series. In terms of where was he in the late 70s and all through the 80s, he was around, but my brother is a lot older than me. And so he was going off to high school before I was in kindergarten, if I can remember that correctly. Yeah, I think that's the case. So he was gone for long hours every day. I wouldn't see him in the mornings, and at night probably not see much of him. And even when he was around, he was doing homework and so on. So my Doctor Who fandom sort of just plodded along in its own way without a lot of guidance from him. Although at the same time, he would have been watching the series and thinking about it and talking about it to his friends at high school to some degree as well. So we sort of grew up in the same house, but not really discussing Doctor Who between us and not really sort of encouraging each other's fandom through that 80s period. In fact, when I think back to when I was in Time Flight in the late 80s there and going into the city and having all those experiences with the Time Flight crew, by that stage, he was a grown man. He was off doing his own thing, and although he liked the show, he wasn't involved with any of that. So, yeah, he was around, but not around, if that makes any sense.
Do you still have any copies of these fanzines, and can you post photos or excerpts of them on Twitter, please?
You know what? That's a really interesting question, and until you asked it, I probably haven't thought about those fanzines for the longest time. I would like to think, and I'm pretty sure there are some fanzines here in my house somewhere. Either, I did two. One was called Wall Scroll, which is a term from Paradise Towers, and I thought was just an awesome name for a fanzine, because obviously you were writing things and, you know, Wall Scroll. The other was called Dragonfire, and I can't remember whether I did Dragonfire before Wall Scroll or whether I did Wall Scroll first, but I would like to think there are copies of Wall Scroll and Dragonfire here in the house. I'm afraid I don't know where, and I don't have them to hand. I probably won't be able to pull them out this anniversary weekend. But you've got me thinking now that's something I'd really like to do, and I'd really like to share those with people. And I'd really like to go back and see, you know, what was I writing for editorials when I was 12 and 13 years of age? And, you know, all that sort of stuff. So you've got me thinking, and you've got me wanting to dig them up. It won't be any time in the next week or so, but, you know, maybe over the Christmas break when I can sit down and, you know, pull out trunks of things and go digging through my junk, I may be able to pull them out. That's a really cool thing. I'd like to do that. I should also have copies of The White Guardian. Now, The White Guardian was the magazine of Time Flight, the club that I joined, and although I wasn't the editor of that publication, I certainly contributed a lot of pieces to it, little cartoons and fiction and reviews of the Doctor Who parties we'd go to in Sydney and things like that. So I've got some White Guardians here as well. So yes, I can do that, just not anytime soon.
This November 23rd, the 51st anniversary of the show, will you be drinking raspberry cordial? If so, I call a toast. Cheers to 51 years of Doctor Who.
The red cordial. I wish, you know, there's no red cordial in my house, and I don't think I've had red cordial in my house or my parents' house for, I don't know, I was probably back at that age, you know, 12, 13 years of age. I don't think I've drank any kind of cordial since then, if I put my mind to it. So, alas, no, I have no cordial of any kind, let alone red, on this anniversary weekend. Maybe I'll raise a mug of cider or beer or something instead. Because, yeah, you're quite right, Lex. 51 years of Doctor Who, what an achievement. And we're flying into the 52nd year. It's an unstoppable juggernaut, and I'm just so proud to be a fan. I'm proud to have other fans here with me working on the Who Wars podcast. And as I said in that piece in You and Who, long may the Doctor reign on our screens. Well, all right, and moving into our second feature for this episode, this 51st anniversary episode for Doctor Who, and I've got to say up front that there's something I've been very happy with regard to Who Wars for the longest time, and it's not something I've really mentioned on any of our previous podcasts, and that's the fact that aside from myself, the entire Who Wars team here is female. Now, you might wonder, why is that such a big deal? And on some levels, you're right, we're all out there in geekdom, guys and girls, we're all having a good time. But when you do look around, and when you especially delve into internet culture and so on, and yes, this is me with my serious hat on for a change, there is a bit of an imbalance with regard to representation out there on podcasts or in blogs or whatever, and that's something that's being addressed, and I think that's really cool. Some podcasts have gone out of their way to address it. You think of, say, the Doctor Who podcast Verity, where every presenter is female and they will only talk to women. That's taking it in one direction. Here on Who Wars, I put out the call for contributors, and the cards just fell a certain way that all of my contributors, all of the team thus far, are women, and I'm cool with that. And in fact, there are times where I sit back and I'm secretly quite pleased with that, because I think Who Wars is out there, you know, giving some representation to female voices in Star Wars and female voices in Doctor Who without making it sort of our mission statement or being deliberately so. And this is the way I'd like to see it happen in the future with a lot more podcasts and blogs and so on, that it's just incredibly natural for there to be a balance of guys and girls out there talking and doing their thing when it comes to their fandom, and whether that's Doctor Who or Star Wars or Star Trek or Firefly or, you know, any of the other great fandoms that are out there. I'd like to see this happen naturally all over the place, just like it's happened here with Who Wars. So, you know, it gave me a lot of pleasure to sit down and interview these three members of the team, one of them being my wife, Leo, Lex, and also Kate. And yeah, look, without any further ado, I'll just hit play on the tape, and you can hear Lex, Leo, and Kate talk about their fandom. I think it's quite cool, because you probably don't get to hear Leo talk about Doctor Who at all, usually on the podcast. She's very much a Star Wars contributor. And Kate doesn't actually review new episodes, so you don't hear her talk about Doctor Who all that often. Sometimes she'll talk about an audiobook or two. Lex is a little more known to you as a Doctor Who reviewer here, but all three of them have their own take on coming to Doctor Who in the post-2005 era, who their favourite Doctors are, and so on. So I hope you find this as interesting as I did recording it, and I'll be back after the third interview. Hiya, Lex.
Hello, Rob.
How are you going?
It's going great. How's yourself?
Warm, but okay.
And the opposite over here. We're freezing over here in America.
Well, we're balancing the earth.
Oh, that's very even-tempered of us. Temperature. Okay.
All right. Now, you've graciously said you'll talk to me about your Doctor Who fandom, so shall we get into that?
I have. Yes, and we shall.
Alrighty. Do you remember when you first came across Doctor Who? It might not have been when you first started watching it. You might have just came across it, not watched it for years, or maybe the first time you came across it, you started watching it. I don't know. How did that all happen?
Well, I think the first time I've ever consciously was aware of Doctor Who being out there was around 2010. Somebody recommended it to me. They said, I should start watching this show called Doctor Who. It's kind of like Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Like, now that I actually know about Doctor Who, it's not so much, but, like, that got me interested. I'm a huge Buffy the Vampire Slayer fan. That was my first love for a television series.
As am I.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And I guess it's, he said that it was kind of campy, and they fight evildoers every episode, and that's, like, it's true, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that got me interested, but my first actually viewing it, I must have seen it before this actual memory. It was through my cousin. She had her own Doctor Who obsession brewing, and whenever I'd go upstairs to visit her, she'd be on the couch watching Doctor Who, always, no matter what. So I'd be seeing snippets since, like, I don't know, maybe 2011, like maybe a year after, let's say.
And what episodes was she watching there?
The first one I remember was coincidentally Rose.
Oh, wow.
I didn't know it was the first episode, but so entirely coincidence that my first taste was the first episode.
Huh.
But to be honest, though, I hated it. I'd heard a lot about it from Doctor Who now, about Doctor Who, sorry. I've heard a lot about it, and then I was surprised, and not in a good way. It was, I thought it was ridiculous, and all these cool people, well, people I regarded as pretty cool, were telling me about it, and, like, they must have all lost their minds. Mannequins running around trying to take over the world, this is ridiculous. And so, I didn't watch much of Rose, I just kind of got up from the couch and tried to see the other relatives, I think. But, you know, I do care about my cousin, so I would see her frequently after that. I'm a good relative. And, she'd still be on the couch, I'd still watch Doctor Who, and... you know, naturally, I just became enticed by the show. It's hard to resist. Once you get watching it, you just kind of understand.
That's right.
I like Rose. I think Rose, that episode was a bit of an exception. We don't have too many mannequins in the other episodes coming alive, right?
Yeah. It's funny because when I've tried to introduce other people to it before, I always wonder whether to show them Rose or not, because although I like the Autons, I like the two John Pertwee Auton stories, they're not used that great in Rose, and there's that slapstick, like with Mickey and the bin, and you know, being sucked into the bin, and it's like, oh, this isn't really the Doctor Who I want to show people, but it does kick off the series.
Yeah, and in fact, I've also, when having a conversation with somebody else, trying to get them into Doctor Who, encouraging them, if their first taste was also Rose, it just, they weren't interested. It's unfortunate that it's the first episode, and people go to see that, and it just isn't an accurate depiction of what Doctor Who is. I don't know. Something,
well,
I don't know. It's a problem for that.
Well, let me go off script for a moment. This question has just popped into my head. If you were showing Doctor Who to someone and you thought, well, I'll start with Eccleston, is there a story in the first Eccleston series you'd rather show them than Rose, just to say this is a taste of what Doctor Who is like and can be?
The Charles Dickens one. What's that one called?
Oh, that's The Unquiet Dead.
The Unquiet Dead. I would go with that one.
Yeah, that's a good one.
It was a good one.
I think I've done that before, and I think I've also used Father's Day as well.
Oh, yeah, that's an interesting one. Definitely, he uses the TARDIS in an interesting way in that episode, you know, going back to the same period of time. It's something that you would think a Time Lord would do frequently.
Mm.
He doesn't. Going to the same moment over and over again, because it's against his rules. But, yeah, that's a great way to introduce Doctor Who. Good, yeah. I like that idea.
Also, you mentioned Buffy the Vampire Slayer earlier. It's jogged my memory back to 2005 when the show was coming back, and, you know, as old school fans, we were like, oh, okay, great, at last. And they said, but it's not going to be 25 minutes per week. It's going to be 45 minutes per week in the style of, say, a Buffy the Vampire Slayer or something. So I remember that show being used as an example for the timing of an episode and how they could tell a story in 45 minutes or so.
Oh, well, that's funny. It is, just like, I didn't realize that they were kind of basing it off that or marketing as that. That's great.
Yeah, that was certainly one of the touchstones. And I think just in TV in general, you know, the 25-minute per week episode format was an older thing. And by the 90s, when Buffy was coming out and other shows around that era, it was going to like 45-minute self-contained stories. And that was certainly an influence there. So, yeah, interesting you mentioned Buffy, among other things.
Yeah. Well, I never would have thought that it would be even a prospect, of a possibility that Doctor Who could be a 25-minute... I mean, it makes sense because the classic episodes are that, but
Yeah.
What a strange thought to think that we could have had that even now. Interesting.
Exactly. And that's why I think the older episodes are sometimes harder for newer fans to get into, among other things, because they look old to begin with and the sets are terrible, the effects are terrible. Like, of course they are. But you have to watch 25 minutes and then another 25 minutes and then another 25 minutes and then another 25 minutes. And that's just for a regular four-part story. And, you know, there are some John Pertwee episodes that are like 6-7 episodes. And they're a real slog. They're meant to be watched 25 minutes per week, but people try and marathon through them to see to see one story, and it becomes a real drag, because the pacing is so different to today's Doctor Who.
I was watching Tomb of the Cybermen this morning.
Oh, classic. And,
it's a good one, really good, except... just to give an example of the pace, it's so much slower. When the Cybermen first make an appearance, they have a full, I think, it's got to be a full 30 seconds of just watching them come out of their honeycomb plastic sheath divider of their tombs. It's so long, so dragged out, and they move so slowly, and the fabric costumes, it's kind of... You can't help but roll your eyes. Just like, when is this going to get on with the show?
Yeah, but it does have that great music in the background. I can picture it in my head even now as they're climbing out of the tombs. There's this 60s kind of cool music.
Oh, no, you're right. And actually, when I was going through that that 30 seconds, I said, well, at least the music's good. It's almost like an opera.
Yeah.
It reminded me of an opera. It's interesting that just people were watching the shows for different reasons. The music was a huge reason. It must have been.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, so there a time you were watching Doctor Who and thought, okay, I'm now a fan, or hey, I think I'm into this more than just, you know, casually watching it?
Yeah, okay, so that was also when I was watching the snippets with my cousin, and I think it was closing time. It was definitely Matt Smith that got me hooked, because, he walks in, saunters, and swivels, waves his arms around. He's just like no one else on television. He's really engaging. It was him in Closing Time, I think. Because I remember another mall scene. Of course, it's another mall scene, just like Rose. But I'm pretty sure that was it. I'm pretty sure it was the Closing Time episode.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that popped out. That pops out in memory. Also, the God Complex. I don't know. I can't remember. The one with the doppelganger.
I
think I saw clips of that one too.
Was that the Rebel Flesh?
Yeah. That's it. Yeah.
Mm.
Yep. So I don't know. Just some of them kind of pop out in my mind. What was the question again? Am I answering the right question?
It was the time where you were watching Doctor Who and thought, "Yeah, I'm a fan of this."
Okay. Good. Yeah. Yep. I'm answering the right question.
Like
the three episodes. I think that I'd sit on it, and I don't know. I can't pick one exactly, but let's go with Closing Time.
Was it the comedy in that appealed?
Yeah. I think it had something to do with, I don't know, the gay men, the partnership jokes that were in that episode. I found highly amusing. I don't know, it was clever.
Yeah, no, it's a fun episode.
Yeah.
All right, I don't know whether we've touched on this or not through your answers. I genuinely don't know the answer to this. So, who is your favorite Doctor?
Matt Smith, because he's the one that got me into Doctor Who, that really interested me. So, Matt Smith. I'm sorry I'm not giving a more interesting answer. It's pretty mainstream, I suppose.
No, not at all. He's a fine Doctor. I think the thing I say about Matt most commonly is I love his portrayal. I don't love all of his episodes, though, if that makes sense.
Yeah, you said that.
Mm.
Have you given an example of before which episodes you don't really care for? It was the plot that... What was it?
Look, it's partly to do with Amy Pond and not liking Amy Pond.
Right, okay.
And she sort of stays through most of his era. I like to see Doctors with different companions.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's probably the Amy Pond thing. And also just, I don't know, you even look at something like Neil Gaiman writing The Doctor's Wife, which I think is brilliant. And then yeah. Nightmare in Silver, which I just thought was terrifically horrible.
Wait, which one was Nightmare in Silver before?
They went to an old deserted, I think it was a fun fair, and they had an old broken down Cyberman as a, I think as a chess player or something.
Yeah!
And then the Cyberman attacked and...
Mm. Yeah, not a fan of that episode as much.
Yeah, it was an odd one.
Some good ones. Some good moments, but overall that was a strange one.
Yeah, and Matt Smith had to wear that cybernetic prosthesis on his face and play himself acting in different ways. And I think, I hear, that was the one time he really cracked it on the set and was like, this is just stupid. Like, it's not a story you'll read in Doctor Who magazine, but it's a story I've heard within fandom that he just didn't like acting in that episode.
Oh, that's funny. Now I want to rewatch that. I thought he did a pretty good job on that, though.
Oh, he did. He's a professional, but I don't think he liked doing it.
That's so funny. Yeah, okay. I have to see that episode again. All right. Thanks for telling me that.
That's okay. Do you think, before we get on to the next question, do you think Matt should have stayed another year or two?
Oh, no. I think he chose a good time to go. He had, like, 3 years and as much as David Tennant thereabouts. I don't know. Compared to the other doctors, that's the same amount. I think it was time to go.
Yeah. For me, he had that split season, so we sort of had him over 2 years, but only one season's worth of stories. Mm. That 7A and 7B season that we have. Maybe if they were both complete seasons, I thought it might have been time for him to go. I felt it was a little premature myself.
Oh.
I maybe wanted another year. But,
I don't know. It seemed like he put a lot into being the doctor, though, and it was exhausting him in some ways. I don't know. Like, he was being spread out too much, too thin. It was wearing him down. I don't know. I don't know. I understood it somehow. Yeah. It made sense to me.
It's funny you should say that, because I looked at some early pictures of him taking the role, and then when he left, and I thought, wow, you've aged about 10 years in the last three.
Yeah. Yeah, he did age.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on, your favorite companion.
My favorite companion. I can't say any of the recent ones so much, I don't think. Yeah. I enjoyed all of them, but something I wish they'll do again is going back to like an older companion. Like I'm thinking of the First Doctor when they used now I can't remember their names.
Ian and Barbara?
Ian and Barbara, thank you.
Yes.
Yeah, they should do something like that again. I did enjoy that dynamic. And now that they have an older doctor, maybe it would be cool if they added in some like older companions. That would be interesting.
Yeah, I guess the oldest companion we've had recently has probably been Donna.
Right, Donna's hilarious. So it definitely goes, like an older companion, it goes to show that that works.
Yeah.
Oh, Donna?
It can work.
Love Donna. Okay. I don't know, they're all so great. It's like trying to pick between family members. You love them all.
And I guess Captain Jack's old. He's lived for hundreds of years, but he still looks fairly young.
Oh, yeah, him too. Yeah. He's younger, though.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And there have been rumors that maybe Capaldi would be better suited to an older woman.
Oh, so you have. Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I think he's great.
Hmm. All right. But did we get an answer for that question?
I'm going back to Ian and Barbara.
Really?
Why not? Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. They are a good pairing.
I spent so many hours watching those classic Doctor Who episodes in the beginning, and I don't know, they're cool people, and I liked the two of them together as a pair. But I guess that I'm cheating, because I'm not answering it as one companion. I'm answering it as two companions.
Oh, I think people see them as a package deal.
Yeah, okay, good. I see them as a package deal, so Ian and Barbara.
Cool. Okay, your favorite villain?
The Master. What's his name? You're going to have to help me out with all the names today. For some reason, my mind's not helping me with that.
Original Master, Deadly Assassin Master, 80s Master.
Sorry, the most recent one before Missy.
Oh, that was John Sim.
John Sim, yes. Mm. You know, and him singing that... I Can't Decide, The Scissor Sisters. I guess that's not in the Netflix version, but I just saw him on some YouTube video doing that, and yeah, forever my favorite evil or bad guy. Not evil.
Now, do you like John Sim where he's the, he's crazy in both sort of roles, but at the end of that Tenant series where he's the Prime Minister and he's in control, or do you like him more sort of out of control, eating lots of roast chickens, wearing the hoodie master from David Tennant's last episode?
Out of control kind.
Definitely. Oh, really?
Yeah.
And his hair is a lighter shade of pale. It's bleached more than previously, yep. And yeah, he's nuts.
Yep. Yes. It was so cool. That is my answer.
Uh-huh. And then at the end of that episode, if I recall, he fought Rassilon and sort of saved the Doctor in some ways. Saved the Earth.
Yeah. So that's why I corrected myself by saying he's not evil, he's just bad. My favorite bad guy.
Cool. All right, then. Your favorite story. And if it's too hard to split between classic and modern, you can have two.
Thanks.
Thanks for making it harder.
Yeah, thanks for making it harder. No, actually, not hard question. I'm just going to give one, and that's the 11th hour, because, you know, I've basically memorized that entire episode.
Yes, that's how we met.
I have the entire episode memorized. Definitely, that's my favorite episode.
Yeah, it does have that fairy tale kind of feel to it.
Yeah, fairy tale. I don't know, it puts me in a happy place. The warm summer night and just sitting out in his suitcase waiting for the Doctor to appear in his complete madness. And at the same time, it's just brutal intelligence. It's so clever. Yeah, it's a great script. Great eye candy, too. Like, it's beautiful sets. I love the interior of the house. Prisoner Zero was a little strange, but it looks cool. So, I don't know, the whole episode? Yes. Major thumbs up. Love it.
Yeah, that's one of the episodes from that series I really like. When I first saw it, I think I had to watch it again and again. I thought, this bodes very well.
Cool. Yep. And it's a very important episode to me.
Yeah. And in fact, looking back, that first Matt Smith series is probably my favorite of his series.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think that first episode, he doesn't... Well, it makes sense because he's discovering himself, like who he is and what kind of doctor he is. So he doesn't really... His acting has changed from that first episode to where he ends up dramatically. I know somebody who doesn't like Matt Smith because of that reason, that he said that it's just too much of a change from how he started to how he ended up. But I don't know.
Interesting.
It wasn't a bad side of him to how he started off. You know, the 11th hour is great.
Yeah.
It is interesting. He has changed. He changed dramatically.
I guess what I'd say to that, if someone said that to me, is he's meant to have aged many, many hundreds of years, if not a thousand years or so, over the course of his era.
Yeah.
And I think if someone picks up on that, then maybe it's because it's deliberately there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's not trying to be the same Doctor he was at the start because he's hundreds of years older.
Yeah, no, that's an appropriate conclusion.
Yeah, I mean, it's a shame we didn't get to see any of these hundreds of years. They were just alluded to that he'd been away doing other stuff, but yeah.
Yeah, it's part of the mystery, part of the appeal.
Certainly leaves it open for people writing books and comics in the future.
Exactly, yeah.
All right, final question on this 51st anniversary episode.
Yeah.
Why do you think Doctor Who appeals to you?
Why does Doctor Who appeal to me? Why isn't this a question that people ask themselves on a daily basis?
It's a good question itself.
Yeah, right? Because outer space is cool and time travel is also... Bow ties are cool.
They are.
A more serious answer. Why do I like Doctor Who?
Let me toss something up. Oh, it's the acting?
Well, yeah, they always pick excellent actors.
Mm-hmm.
And because everything and anything can happen, does happen on this show. Mm-hmm. It just, I don't know, it's just you can't contain this show. It can go on forever. That's another great part of Doctor Who. It's something that I can always depend on kind of being there, and there's so much to discover about it. It's endless. Mm. But what were you going to suggest?
Well, see, I don't know what your TV habits are like very much outside of Doctor Who, so I was going to throw it up, and this could be right or it could be wrong or somewhere in between. Is it the Englishness of the show? Are you a bit of an Anglophile and you're into that kind of thing?
Oh my God, I am. Yeah. No, I've been doing a British accent since I was like, since I could talk, so like age of two or something like that. I was doing an English accent. You've no idea. Yeah.
Right. So,
yeah, definitely. That's probably part of it too. I'm an Anglophile.
Yeah. Because I think there's something about this show that just wouldn't work if it was made in the US, for example.
Yeah, that's true. Yep, there's something about being British.
Yeah, in the same way that there are many US shows and movies which I think if the English remade them, they'd just be ridiculous as well, so.
Yeah. So, I think, that's a fairly complete answer, right? Why we like Doctor Who. God, that was a hard question, though.
That's why it was the last question.
Yeah.
Well, look, thank you so much for chatting with me.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, my pleasure. And now let's move on to Kate. Hiya, Kate.
Hello.
Now, do you remember when you first came across Doctor Who? It might not even be when you started watching it, or maybe it is when you started watching it. Do you remember when that might have been?
Well, I kind of remember hearing about Classic Who. I have older brothers and that are into sci-fi and stuff. But when I really started to get interested in it was when it got put on Netflix. People, like my friends and stuff, they kept telling me that I needed to watch it. And I was like, yeah, whatever. But it wasn't really until it got put on Netflix. And then, so I think that was like about 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, then I just kind of binge watched it and then caught up. I think it was series 6 when I started watching it, like week to week.
Gotcha. Yeah, Netflix is a very US kind of phenomenon. I think they're trying to expand out into the world. I think they'll end up in Australia eventually. So, I was certainly going to ask when Netflix might have put that out, because I've heard that with a lot of shows. You know, sometimes when people in the US, when Netflix gets something, loads of people pile in and just binge watch it. And
yep.
I think that might be the case with the Clone Wars stuff as well for Star Wars.
Definitely.
Okay. So I was going to ask when you started watching it and why. So say you're thinking about 2010 or so?
Yeah, I think that was about the time. It was actually really good timing because I got caught up in everything and then before I went to London. So. Oh.
You went to London for a holiday or to work?
Yeah.
Or? Oh, okay.
Yeah, just for a trip.
Ah, very nice. And was there lots of Doctor Who stuff there?
No, it was actually disappointing because every gift shop and stuff I was going into, I was looking for Doctor Who stuff. It was kind of off season. There wasn't a current season or anything, but it was really hard to find stuff, which was really bizarre to me.
How weird.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's rewind a bit to that 2010. You've got friends saying, hey, watch Doctor Who. It's on Netflix. You start watching it.
Uh-huh.
Can you pinpoint a time where you thought, okay, I'm into this, I'm a fan, you know, I'm watching this more than just another show, you know, did it ever stand out to you that moment?
Pretty much Run, right away when he says Run, you know, with Rose and the Ninth Doctor.
Really? That quick?
Oh, yeah. It was right away. I was hooked.
Oh, fantastic. Oh, that's a very Ninth Doctor thing to say, actually. Subconsciously channeling him. Yeah, no, I think that's a very exciting moment in the episode Rose, and gosh, that is very early.
That's how I roll.
Well, you know, you've just mentioned Eccleston hooked you on the show, but do you have a favourite Doctor? I'm guessing it's not Eccleston, actually, based on what I know about you.
Well, he's my first Doctor, and he is fantastic, but yeah, Tennant's my favourite.
And what attracts you to Tennant?
I think he's a really excellent actor, and I don't know. It's hard to describe.
Well, if we compare Tennant and Eccleston, is it that he's, I guess he's a bit goofier than Eccleston, maybe? Is that the appeal?
Yeah, I guess. I don't even know if it's that, though, but I don't even know.
Or is it just the hair?
He does have nice ruffly hair.
So how did you feel when he left and Matt Smith stepped in?
I was a little traumatized.
tell me more about that.
Actually, there's still one episode I haven't watched. The very last one with him in it. I just couldn't bring myself to do it.
Really?
Yeah. I might someday, but...
So his last story is a two-parter, so you've only watched the first part of it?
Oh!
Or have you watched none of it?
I don't remember, no. I might not have watched either part.
Oh, gosh. So... So you've seen him regenerate because you get a flashback, I guess, at the start of Matt Smith's era.
Yeah, I knew that he was regenerated, and so I watched that part of it, and then I went into Matt Smith.
Oh, Kate, I think you've got to go and watch that story. It's a fun one.
Okay.
Oh, you know, but that's not without precedence. I know my wife got towards the end of a computer game once. And she didn't want it to end, so she just stopped playing it. I said, are you crazy?
And then it can live in your heart forever.
Yeah. So it's something I would never do, but I understand it. I've seen people do it with things. You with Doctor Who, my wife with this computer game. But gosh, yes, it's so long ago now. Yeah, you can go back. Maybe. Oh, or just, I don't know, sensitive souls, maybe.
Yeah.
All right. Now, thinking about companions, do you have a favorite companion?
I really liked Rose a lot. And so I think it's kind of a tie between Rose and Amy.
Interesting.
Because I really liked Amy, too.
Okay. And what was the appeal of Rose first?
I just like her attitude and, like, her can-do spirit.
Mm-hmm. Yep. She's a shop girl who made good.
Yeah. I really liked her family. Like, her mom was really cool. Mickey was pretty good.
Ah, right.
Friends and family. And that's kind of part of... Martha's not really my favorite. I didn't like her family. They were so annoying. That's not her fault, but...
is that because they didn't like the doctor?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I guess Rose's mum didn't like the doctor either, but, you know, she was funny with it, whereas... Martha's mum was a bit severe.
She kind of did towards the end, didn't she?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she, when I think Eccleston sent Rose back to Earth so she didn't get killed, I think she appreciated that.
Yeah.
But they always had that interesting sort of relationship.
Yeah.
But, yeah, Martha's mum was a lot more severe. There wasn't much joking with her.
Yeah.
And Amy, what appealed about Amy?
I really liked the whole Amy and Rory dichotomy. I thought that was pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I liked how it went really far back with her as she was a little girl when she first saw the doctor. And so it really was a part of her life. And I thought that was an interesting take on it.
Yeah, that was certainly quite different for, I'm trying to cast my mind back, I think for any companion. I think we meet most of them when they're fully grown adults, not when they're kids.
Yeah.
Okay.
I might actually cosplay as Amy in December.
Okay. Is it at a convention or something?
Yeah, at the Phoenix Comic Con.
Alrighty. So if anyone listening is at...
Who group going.
Very cool. So if anyone's there and you see Amy Pond walk by, say, hey, Kate, and see what happens.
Oh, there might be more than one Amy Pond there, but...
I know. That's why it'll be funny for people to be saying, hey, Kate, to all these other Amys.
Yeah. Oh, there you go.
Now, in terms of villains, I think you can see where these questions are going. Do you have a favourite villain or adversary for the Doctor?
No, by favourite, what do you mean by that?
Oh, well, you might not like them, but you might enjoy stories with them in it.
I think I gotta go with the Daleks, you know?
Oh, really? Yeah?
Yeah, they're so iconic and, you know, exterminate.
So it's not the Master, it's not the Cyberman, it's not any of those big ones, probably the Daleks for you.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Now, have any particular stories stood out over the last few years?
Oh, definitely. I think there's a couple of them.
Now,
definitely The Empty Child.
Yes.
You know, that two-parter was so good. But I don't know if That might be my favorite, or the Vincent Van Gogh one's definitely one of my favorites.
Ah, oh, Vincent and the Doctor, yeah, very much.
Yeah, those ones are good.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, The Empty Child, the second part to that was called The Doctor Dances.
Yeah.
And I remember when I heard back in 2005 that the upcoming episode was called The Doctor Dances, I thought that was such an odd name for a Doctor Who episode. You know, for us older fans, when the show came back, it did some new things, and one of them was having stories with strange names. And when I heard it's called The Doctor Dances, I thought, that's not a Doctor Who episode name. Oh, you know, it's not, you know, because to me, Doctor Who episodes are, you know, Death to the Daleks, or, you know, The Seeds of Doom, or whatever. The Doctor Dances? Ah. But then after I saw it, I thought, oh, yeah, that was pretty cool.
Yeah, that was a good one.
Now, the big question, and you can take this anywhere you like, why do you think Doctor Who appeals to you?
Well, I was kind of thinking about in the sci-fi genre in general. I think a lot of us really like sci-fi because we feel very alien in nature.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So, yeah, just, and it's funny because a lot of my friends who are Doctor Who fans, it's like, it's just something that's similar. It's part of your brain, I think.
Do you find with yourself or with your friends, obviously you're in the US, do you find your Anglophiles, do you find you start watching even more British shows or being into British things that maybe your friends, other friends aren't?
Yeah, I've always been, well, my heritage is a big portion British.
Right.
But I've always been really, like, going to London was always my dream. I've always just had that in me. Mm-hmm. I'm a huge Beatles fan.
Did you get to go up to Liverpool when you were in the UK?
No, I didn't. Oh. I didn't want to go. I need to go again.
Well, it's a good excuse.
Oh, yeah. I did do Abbey Road.
Very cool.
Yeah.
And a much shorter flight from the US to the UK than it is to Australia, because if I was to go to the UK, it's almost a 24-hour trip.
Ooh, yeah. That's long.
And maybe longer, depending on what kind of stopovers you do on the way.
Oh, man. Yeah. That's brutal.
Yeah. Okay, so very cool. Yeah, I often think this about US fans of Doctor Who, whether the people watching it are Anglophiles or, you know, to some people, maybe not necessarily just the US, but the Doctor, his eccentricness comes across very strongly and differently to perhaps how it might be perceived in the UK, where being eccentric is kind of a way of life for many people in Britain.
That's true. Yeah.
All right. Well, that's very cool. Thank you for joining us here in our little, 23rd of November special for the 51st anniversary.
Yeah.
It's a strange sort of anniversary. 51st. It doesn't have quite the ring of 50th.
And it's not like 42.
No, not 42 either, no. But, thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, thanks for that, Kate. And now we'll move over to Leo to talk about her Doctor Who fandom and how she came across the show. How are you, Leo?
Hello, I'm fine. How are you?
I'm not bad at all. Now, do you remember when you first came across Doctor Who? It might not have even been when you started to watch it. It could have been, you know, you just heard about it somewhere.
No, I didn't know anything about Doctor Who until I started dating you.
Is that right?
That's right.
Not even in pop culture it hadn't come up, like, you know, Tom Baker or long scarves or any references or...
No, not in the US. It just, you know, I think it was kind of had a cult following kind of thing, and you had to be in the cult to know about it. Or you had to have, be surrounded by lots of diehard sci-fi people. And I just didn't really have that sort of group at that point in my life, so I didn't really have anyone to introduce me to it.
Well, fair enough. So I was going to ask, when did you start watching it and why? You've sort of foreshadowed that, but maybe you can tell the story.
Well, this one time, you showed me an episode. Now, I don't remember the name of it, but I knew it was the two-parter one, you know, the one I'm talking about, but I can't remember the name of it.
Did I start you not on episode one of the show?
No, you did not. You started me on the kids with the gas masks and the Are You My Mummy thing.
Oh, so The Empty Child and The Doctor Dances.
Yeah.
Did I really?
Yeah.
gosh, normally I'm a stickler for, you know, starting people on the first episode of a new series, you know, and I'll sometimes warn them, like, hey, this could be a bit boring, it's introducing everything, you know, but it gets better. Oh, did I really start you halfway through?
You did, and that kind of put me off for a little bit, but then, I mean, I liked the characters and I liked the setting, but I really didn't know what to make of it, so it kind of startled me a little bit.
Oh, wow. Oh, the things you learn. I can't even remember doing that. This would have been, what, about, was it 2007 or 8 or something around then?
I get years confused. That doesn't help me a whole lot.
Yeah, fair enough. I think it would have been around then. I think the show had probably been going for a year or two at that point. All right. Now, was there a time when you were watching it and you thought, hey, I'm a fan, or maybe not I'm a fan, but I'm into this more than just any other show? Maybe when you clicked with the Doctor or with Rose or just with the theme of the show, can you sort of pinpoint that at all?
It's a bit hard with Doctor Who because there's a lot of standalone episodes, and it's a lot of, it's not a very traditional American sort of format, so I had to adjust to a lot, and I can't think of any particular moment where I really got into it. I think I just really liked the dynamic between Rose and the Ninth Doctor. That probably pulled me in. But as a show, even now, I have a hard time kind of putting my finger on how do you describe Doctor Who? What is it about it? It's kind of a patchwork of all sorts of little stories and ideas. That's quintessentially British. I mean, that's the only thing that kind of holds it all together in my head.
And it does sort of change from era to era. It's harder for new fans to see this. I mean, as classic era fans, myself and others can see, oh, this producer and, you know, script editor produced a different kind of series to the ones who went before. I think people are now starting to see the Moffat era is different to the Russell T. Davies era. And they're sort of starting to see that.
Oh, that there's definitely major differences there. That's for sure. But maybe because the Moffat era has been so long now that it's hard to remember what it was like before. Or if you get companions that last more than a whole season, you forget what the other companions were like. Diversity doesn't always seem to come through as much when the same sort of themes and the same sort of characters are used over and over.
Yeah, I agree, and I know you would agree with this because we've obviously spoken about this a lot, but I think Amy Pond stayed far too long in the show, for example.
Far too long. Oh, don't even get me started.
You know, I look back to the Tennant era, and Tennant was running around with Rose for a bit, and then he was running around with Martha for a bit, then he was running around with Catherine Tate for a bit, or Donna, I should say, and then he was running around on his own for a bit and had different companions in every one of the specials, and that was the kind of diversity that I really liked, and I think that you probably liked too.
Yeah, and in saying that, I mean, Eccleston was still my favorite Doctor because he was my first, but Tennant, yeah, there was just so much different stuff going on, and that kept you engaged because you just didn't know what to expect with each episode.
Yeah, and then we get to Smith, and it's like they're wanting to tell the Amy Pond story, and that's fine, but then it gets to the end of the first series, and she's still there, and then we get through another series, and she's still there, and then she's still there for halfway through another series after that. It's like, I would have liked a bit more variety with Smith.
Yeah, especially given that he's a great person to watch on screen, same with Capaldi. It's just, I love these guys, but their stories are starting to become more and more about the companion. And I can sort of see why Moffat especially wants to do that, because the companion is the quote-unquote relatable character that we can experience things through. But I don't care about their story. I want to know about this old Time Lord, you know? I want to know what he's getting up to. He's seen heaps of things that we still haven't seen yet.
Yeah, I think it's right to have the companion story as part of the overall, you know, piece, but I think Moffat does take it too far and has taken it too far at times, you know, especially in the Smith era. I think Capaldi started to pull it back. He had a few good episodes and a few good scenes in this last series.
Yeah. But we'll see what Moffat decides to do in the future. I don't have really high expectations, but yeah.
All right, well, let's get into some quickfire sort of stuff. I think you've already foreshadowed this first one, but who is your favourite Doctor and why?
Eccleston. The short answer, because he was the first, and you always feel that nostalgia when you're introduced to something for the first time, that first experience that you can never get back again when in the future. It's, you're always going to be drawn that way. But also because he's a soldier and he's got that dark, mysterious vibe, and he's easy on the eyes, and and he just, he always knew, he always seemed to be sort of in control, and he knew what he was doing, but he wasn't lording it over anybody.
Mm. Yeah, I wish we'd seen more of him.
Oh, I would have killed to see more of him. I really wanted to.
All right, then, into the favorite companions. Do you have a particularly favorite companion and why?
That's harder, because I liked all the, I liked Rose, I liked Martha, I liked Donna. Clara, when she first started, I really liked her, but then she suffered from the same thing as Amy Pond, and her relationship with Danny ended up reminding me so much of Amy and Rory. Favorite companion, probably Rose. Similar reasons to Eccleston, but because she was just so normal, and I could personally identify with her, and that feeling of, you know, you're not going anywhere with your life, but then someone shows up and takes you on this adventure, and don't we all want to experience that?
So if Eccleston's your favorite and you like Rose, is it their pairing together that you like, or do you like Rose with Tennant more?
That's a hard question, because I do like both a lot, but I don't think I could put one before the other. Obviously, the relationship starts with Eccleston, and that moment, that kiss, you know, you're like, oh, you can't dismiss that. That was just amazing. But that wasn't where most of the relationship stuff happened. It just kind of started at that point.
Yeah, that's right.
And if we had more of Eccleston, we could have had some great stuff. But alas, we do not. So I don't mind her with Tennant. Like, they had some great stories together too. And then they had more stuff with like Mickey later on. That was kind of cool. And there were, you know, they're kind of those two pairings are kind of equal in my head, I guess.
Okay, cool. Is there a favorite villain or monster that stood out over the years?
I think I like the Master, especially in, I don't remember episode names. The arc with Martha and her family, and, you know, he's the politician and all that. That I really enjoyed. I really, because he's a great manipulator, and I've always enjoyed characters that can get people to do what they want.
Okay, so not the End of Time, where he was completely deranged and eating lots of roast chicken.
No, that got a bit weird.
Yeah, but where he was more in control and acting as the Prime Minister and so on.
Oh, yeah. I love political sort of villains, yeah.
Yeah, no, that was a very good Master. What about Missy as the Master and a female Master? Did you like that?
I would have liked her a lot more if she wasn't the Master. I think she had... Okay, we saw very little of Missy for most of the season, so it was hard to really judge her as a character. And then when she explodes on the scene, that was good. I liked how she was kind of half manic, and you almost kind of wanted to just see what she would do next. But as the Master, I don't know. I'm still not really happy with that. She doesn't really do him a great... She doesn't really do much for his legacy that I find very endearing.
Okay, fair enough. Does a particular story over the years stand out as a favorite?
God, I knew you were going to ask that, and I really can't think of one, but there's just so many good stories. I don't know, Rob. I really can't think of any one story at the moment.
All right, then. Fair enough. Now, look, to close up, why do you think Doctor Who appeals to you and has appealed to you in the past? I know you're sort of waning at the moment with the series.
The easy answer is it's sci-fi and it involves time travel, and we get to see distant worlds, and there's all kinds of unique things that happen in Doctor Who that just don't really exist in other stories or shows. But I think what I'm always wanting to know more about the Doctor, and I always want to see where he's been and where he's going, and the fact that it's British, I think this is because I come from an American background that I don't know a lot about British things, and Doctor Who has always been my sort of window into to British culture and the way they do things and the way they approach things, and I've always kind of enjoyed that.
Okay, cool. So with you saying that you like the sci-fi aspect, you know, traveling through the universe and so on, was this last Capaldi series a little disappointing insofar as so much of it was Earth-based?
Yeah, it was. Except I liked the heist. That was good.
What about Mummy on the Orient Express? That was in space, at least.
It was in space, but it didn't feel spacey. I enjoyed the episode for what it was, and it had some good stuff, but it didn't do any sci-fi-ness for me, if that makes any sense.
No, fair enough.
And I'm thinking back now to an Eccleston episode, but the first episode with Rose, where he takes her to the station to watch the explosion of Earth, and I really enjoyed that episode. There were aliens there, that's when the world really opened up. And I haven't really had that feeling in a long time. The last two seasons especially have just been kind of, eh. I mean, I liked the 50th anniversary. There was some great stuff in there, but it still kind of left me wanting. I wanted to see more of Gallifrey and more of the Time Lords, and I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting. When Smith did a really spacey sci-fi episode, I think it was The Rings of Akatane, and we, both of us, absolutely hated it.
Yeah.
It was the one with all the kids singing and all of that.
It just felt just, what is this? I don't understand what they were trying to achieve with that episode.
Well, I felt that with a lot of that season 7 stuff of Smith's.
I know, I'm thinking back to some Tenet episodes, like the one where he confronts the devil itself, and I love that one. That was great.
That was fantastic.
Because it did a nice... Usually I don't like mixing mystical stuff with sci-fi, because I'm like, oh, God, if I wanted mystical, I'd go read some fantasy novel or something. But they did such a wonderful job with that, with how they set it up. And any episode where Tennant's in his spacesuit's probably a good episode.
Very cool. All right, well, look, thank you for sharing your thoughts with us about Doctor Who as we sit here on the 51st anniversary. It's been enlightening.
Well, thank you. I hope I haven't been too negative.
No, all views are appreciated here.
Okay.
Well, okay, and that's where we'll end the interviews there. That was, of course, myself talking to my wife, Leo, and before that, chatting with Kate, and before that, chatting with Lex. Just very, very different answers from all three of the ladies there, even with regard to the same topics, and even growing up in the same era, and watching the modern stuff initially. They've all come to it in slightly different ways, had slightly different takes, and I'm sure that's true for all of you out there as well. You may have been listening to these stories and thinking parts of them were similar to your own stories, but other parts were different. And that's the beauty of fandom, I guess. It's that we all come to this one show, which is, you know, just this one central thing, and yet we all do it in different, incredibly different, in some cases, ways. And especially as the years go on, and, you know, the 2005 series now is, 9 years ago? And when the new series of Doctor Who comes out, it'll be the 10th anniversary of the show returning to our screens. Someone might be picking up, you know, the box set of Series 1 next year sometime and watching that, and watching it as a 10-year-old series. Their experience will be different to someone who was watching it, maybe following it even before it started in 2005, and their experience of it at that time. So you can tell I'm fascinated by the way people come to different things like this, and historically how people view things depending on what era they're viewing them from. It's like a 12-year-old today watching a 1974 Doctor Who serial or something. How do they perceive that compared to a 12-year-old in 1974? I could go on all day about this kind of topic, but I'll stop there and we'll get on to our closing thoughts for the show. Well, here we are at the end of the 17th Who Wars, and as always, my thanks go to Leo, Lex, and Kate for being such great members of the Who Wars team, and of course to you out there for listening, whether you're listening to this on the 23rd of November 2014, or whether you're listening to it in a week's time or a month's time, maybe even a year's time. Who knows when you might listen to this, but thank you for listening to it. As I always say, if you do have an iTunes account, I'd love you to open it up and give us a rating and a review. That helps us bump up the rankings a little, helps other people like yourself find us on iTunes. So if you know you'd like other people to hear us, that's a great way to help us. It's a free way to help us. It takes 10 seconds of your time, but it would mean so much to us. So thank you for listening. Thank you if you can help us out on iTunes. Thanks again to the team. Happy birthday, Doctor Who. 51 years old today. An incredible achievement. And I don't see it stopping anytime soon, which is just fantastic. Have a good night, everyone. I'm Rob Irwin, and I'll see you next week on Who Wars.
Well, that wraps it up for another episode of Who Wars. If you'd like to be in touch with the show, simply email hello@whowars.net. Find us on Twitter @WhoWars, or if Facebook's more your thing, at facebook.com/WhoWars. Oh, and don't forget to leave us a rating on iTunes. See you next time.
Oh.